On this week's 51%, hear from a sports reporter and columnist about the state of her profession, and we meet a woman whose brother's suicide prompted her to try and help others, even just a little.
You know, there has to be a way to get this out into the world because we should be thinking about our mental health on a daily basis.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Jane McManus has been in some high-stress rooms during her more than two decades covering New York sports, from the Final Four to the Super Bowl. Now the veteran of ESPN, the New York Times, USA Today, and many other outlets is taking on a new challenge. In December, McManus began her job as director of the Marist College Center for Sports Communication in Poughkeepsie, New York. A graduate of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, where she also taught, McManus is a columnist for the New York Daily News and even played roller derby for 7 years. 51%'s Ian Pickus asked McManus how she became a journalist, a sports journalist, in the first place.
So I was living in New York City in the early 90s, working at a law firm. And I'd thought coming out of college that I wanted to go to law school. So I was playing a ton of basketball at the time also. I'd played pickup basketball all through college at St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland, which did not have a Division I, II, or III program. So it was all intramurals. And I played not only for the women's or intramural team, but for the men's. And I played a ton of pickup with men. And it was a small school, so women would come out and play pickup too. And then when I moved to the city, I still wanted to play pickup. So I went down to the Prospect Park Y, where I was generally the only woman playing. So I was playing a ton of basketball. I was watching the Knicks all the time. I was a huge fan of that Patrick Ewing, John Starks team, and that ethos, that, you know, hard-playing ethos. I like to think that I had adopted that in my own pickup style, but we'll say.
Were you on the perimeter or down low?
I had a nasty three-pointer.
Okay.
And a bit of a stealth three-pointer. So I was able to kind of prove my worth. I also played a lot of defense, which is something in pickup games you can get a lot of or not at all. So the fact that I was willing to, you know, run down the court on a, you know, on a breakaway was a benefit to me in those games. So I was thinking about what am I going to do? And I'd been on the high school paper in junior high. I'd been my editor of my junior high paper, and I'd also been in a high school paper. And I was rollerblading with my friend Nadja James in Prospect Park, lamenting, what am I going to do with my life? And she said, Jane, you should be a sports writer. And I hadn't even thought about women being sports writers, really. Like, it just hadn't really occurred to me. And when she said it, it just was clarity. You know, I was like, that's exactly what I should do. I love sports. I've always loved reporting. I should totally do it. And it just was that simple, that somebody outside of me had to kind of make that a reality a bit for me. And and from there, I ended up kind of, you know, setting the path. Right. Like, so I didn't go to J school right away, but I started kind of making the steps that would make it possible for me to do that. And then I went to J school knowing that I wanted to be a sports writer.
The people who were trailblazers as far as being women in sports journalism are still alive. It hasn't been that long. Did you face any particular challenges when you were starting out that you are now telling your current students about?
Well, I think every woman in the business has faced challenges based on gender. I think, you know, unfortunately, it just has to be expected. Less so, hopefully, today, although the stories that I get from my students who are women who go into the business, I hear some pretty disappointing things. I hear some great things as well, and some of them are doing, you know, really terrific. But it is kind of one of those things where you have to, you know, you can't be so sensitive that it drives you out. And I think it does drive some women out. But the thing about it is that there aren't so many women in the business even now, and certainly back when I got in, there weren't so many women in the business that it was, you know, normal to see women in the locker room. And you might be kind of in your own little, you know, your own little bubble when it comes to whatever sport you're covering or high schools or anything else where you're the only woman in your particular area covering something.
And also the stuff you've chosen, I don't know if chosen or been assigned to cover over the years, but you were early on the WNBA, you know, the New York Liberty. You've written a lot about the stars of tennis, and it seems there's, you know, the idea of being a woman in a sports locker room, but then also being a woman who's paying attention to issues of, you know, race and gender and things like that in your coverage. How conscious are you of the things you want to write about?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think every woman who comes into this business, even if you didn't get into it to cover women's sports, let's say, and I certainly didn't, as I said, I was a Knicks fan, I was a basketball player. That's kind of the background, and that's mm-hmm. what led me into the business. But I think at some point, you, just by virtue of what you see and what you hear and what you care about, you kind of have to make a choice. And that is, are you going to be the one person on the staff generally who pays attention to women's sports and gives it coverage? And this is certainly true 15 years ago, I think, more so than it's true now, because I certainly have male colleagues that care very much about women's sports and cover them. But I've talked to a lot of women about this. And, you know, at some point you do become sensitized to the type of coverage that women get as professional athletes. You know, it's very meaningful to me. I had the opportunity to be an intern at a place the year that the Liberty started playing in Madison Square Garden. And as a virtue of working at a law firm, I'd been able to get a lot of tickets to games because there were seats available through the firm. And so I'd seen the Knicks play 20 times, you know, from Madison Square Garden, and just loved it. And to see that first game where the Liberty came out onto the court, the lights darkened and their names were called, and here you had professional women's basketball at Madison Square Garden, it was deeply meaningful to me. And I try very hard to be objective and to not let my emotions come into things, but that really meant something to me. And I feel like it's important to notice issues that people aren't. And this is why it's important to have diversity on a staff, right? Because certain people are going to have an eye to look in certain corners. And if you hire a woman on staff, she probably is going to be more aware of women's sports. Not always. And it's not always going to be something that you can count on. But, you know, generally that might happen. And I think that's, you know, that to me has been, you know, a strength of mine and something that I felt was important to do and something that I enjoy.
And I mean, traditionally, the sports department has been a lot of old white guys. So there is something to, you know, just seeing it through a different set of eyes.
Well, exactly. There's a lot of baseball coverage in New York, yeah. You know, and that's because a lot of the editors have really loved baseball. And, you know, they may not have paid attention to roller derby or women's basketball or some of the other things. I mean, if you look at the coverage of the New York Liberty over the years, you know, unlike the Mets or the Yankees, where you have a consistent person who's the beat writer covering it, a lot of times the Liberty have gotten kind of spot coverage, whoever's available. There's been not been consistency and no one's traveled with the team. So, you know, that kind of coverage, right, paints a different picture. It's telling readers what the paper or the outlet values. And people pick that up. And I can remember when I started covering. So when I was at the Journal News, and one of my first jobs was to cover girls basketball. And back then, and I think certainly now, there are a lot of papers that really work hard to give equal coverage to the boys and the girls at the prep level. And that was certainly the case with my paper and with girls basketball. But it was impossible for me not to notice how that changed as you went to college basketball, mm-hmm. how that changed as you went to professional basketball. And so, you know, it's something that's certainly notable. And, you know, people have to have a reason to change their minds on something and to care. And I can remember the letters that I would get, like, why aren't you covering X, Y, and Z more? And sometimes they can just be dismissed as, oh, people are always going to complain about your coverage. But at the same time, you know, I got a lot of letters from girls and from women saying, why aren't we doing more coverage of women's sports?
I don't want to get you into trouble, but since you did raise it, you're writing for the New York Daily News now, still in this new position. You've had to notice all of the cuts, especially in the sports department. And, you know, as we get ready for a new baseball season, there's a question of how much these things will be staffed. What's the state of that paper today?
Well, I don't think I'm breaking any rules here by saying that we're staffing baseball coverage with beat writers who will travel. So that's one thing. We also have Wally Matthews, who's a fantastic yeah. columnist and, you know, covers baseball as well as anybody. Yes, it's a huge problem at the Daily News. The July cuts were devastating. I wasn't there yet, and I was devastated by it because I've always, you know, read that paper and cared about it, and I think it's vital for New York sports that the Daily News thrives, which is part of the reason that I'm there. But yes, the cuts that are happening, not just at the Daily News, but across the industry, are devastating. And it's particularly disruptive because we know people care about the news and care about information, are consuming it more than ever. And yet the financial model is eroding. And so it's not necessarily a problem of journalism and journalists not doing their jobs or journalism being less valuable. It's a problem of finding a financial model. In some ways, that's something that reporters don't have a lot of control over. So I think it's very frustrating for people in the industry right now. But the thing that I always think about is, you know, the industry that we had in 1995 is not here today. If we'd taken a snapshot in 2000, we have a different industry. If you take the snapshot now, it looks pretty bleak, but it is not what will be here, you know, in 2025, in 2030. We are a changing industry, and we're currently in the middle of a very painful transition, but I don't believe that it's always going to be like this. And that's the only reason I was able to take the job at Marist as well.
And are you more or less likely to encourage students to get into the field, knowing what we know about today's financial outlook? Like when you talk to people at Marist who are 21, 22, and they're seeing that light at the end of the tunnel, are you giving them encouragement to get into it, or is it more of a jaundiced view?
Well, absolutely. I think you need to open your eyes and see what's there. Everybody needs to do that. It's not a sunny picture only. But at the same time, you know, the people who are getting jobs in today's economy are younger writers and reporters. And the reason for that is because they're less expensive. And if you can get a toehold in this business and you can take that opportunity and run with it, then you have a place here. So in some ways, I am more concerned about the reporters and writers at, you know, at my age, right, with 20, 30 years experience in the business, because those are the ones with salaries who tend to be let go. And it's the younger reporters and writers who are getting the opportunities. And again, I don't want them to come into this business only to have a 10-year career and then have to leave. But what I would like to see is they get in this business, they prove themselves, and we see as the financial model evolves.
We're speaking with Jane McManus, who has a tough job, director of the Marist College Center for Sports Communication. Okay, so I said we'd get back to Marist. You showed up December 1 on campus. What are your goals for that program and for yourself there?
Well, I'm really excited about, first of all, just getting to know people. There's some amazing things happening at Marist right now. First of all, the equipment that they have, the technology that they have access to is really top-notch. There's an ESPN3 connection, and ESPN3 broadcasts all the games at Marist, and students have the opportunity to work on that broadcast, hands-on experience, cutting replays in the production. You know, it's a really great opportunity for students who are interested in that. And also just to get a feel of how things work. Sometimes I think when you're coming into the business, it's not just enough to be able to write a story. It's not just enough to be able to stand in front of a camera and talk. It's not just enough to be able to know your way around a soundboard. You really have to have a little bit of everything, because you don't know what slot you're going to be able to fit into based on where the jobs are when you're graduating. So I think having that kind of well-rounded approach to what students are exposed to is super important. I am trying to bring in some speakers as well. We have Jessica Luther coming in. She wrote a terrific book about Baylor called Unsportsmanlike Conduct, has been really one of the leaders in NCAA coverage when it comes to accountability. And so she'll be coming in. And we also have Chris LaPlaca, who's the head communications VP at ESPN. And he'll be in to talk to some of our students as well about his job and what it entails and, you know, crisis communications and all of that kind of thing. So I think that's something that I'm looking forward to. I'd like to see us be able to do a little bit more research, do some big picture storytelling, podcasting. We have a lot of things that we have the technology to do and that I think I'm excited to try to get into place.
What's one sports story you think isn't getting enough attention right now?
You know, I would say I always think about that there's a story to be written about the NFL's reason for being in London and what it plans to do there. They spend a lot of resources on having an office in London and having four games a year in London. They've helped renovate a stadium in London. And I think we have to, you know, Roger Goodell kind of said that the idea of having a team in London full time is on hold. But I think it would be interesting to get in financially what they think the purpose of those London games is and really delve into kind of their overall strategy on overseas building the game. The other thing I would love to see more coverage on is FIFA's treatment of women who play soccer and the resources that are devoted to the women's game. We've seen, you know, with World Cup coming up, we've seen that coverage of women in this country at the World Cup level draws well more of an audience than men's coverage does. So that's not something that happens across the world. But why isn't the success of the women's game in the U.S. able to pull up and allow for more resources worldwide? I would like to see something done on that.
And in terms of what they're paid to win a championship compared to the men.
Absolutely.
It's totally not equitable.
No, it's not. And it's interesting because in this country, women's soccer is so much, again, in international competition, women's soccer is more popular than men's. So the argument, that financial argument or the people don't care argument, does not apply here. And so in an instance where it doesn't apply, why aren't resources then being driven toward the more popular part of the sport?
Our time is short, so let me put you on the hot seat and give you some quick hits here. Has Twitter been a net positive or negative for sports reporting?
Positive.
You're on it.
It's personally a push, I think. You know, there's a lot of negativity that comes with being on the platform as a woman or a person of color, for sure. But at the same time, you know, it's a great way to get out information. It's a great way to find out information. It's a great way to watch live sports because you're communicating with fans live as things happen. You kind of tap into the hive mind. I think it's been fantastic. And you can see that, I think, because, you know, the NFL was putting some live games on Twitter. Even they realize how much social media and that live ability to exchange information and post photos of your television screen. You know, who thought that it would be fun to post pictures from your television screen? But there you go. During live coverage. I mean, that has been a real boon to sports in general.
Serena Williams, greatest ever?
I think it'd be hard to argue that she isn't. And not only greatest ever, but still in contention for majors this year. I think, you know, she's only got one more to go before she beats Margaret Court's all-time record of 24 Grand Slam victories. She has 23, Serena. I cannot imagine that she doesn't tie it and possibly beat it. Her work ethic is incredible. I think what the way that she's been revealing her personal life, although certainly very good for her branding, and you could cynically look at it and say, you know, she just wants to improve her brand. But she's been doing some things that I think are very very interesting and very revealing. And it's been fun to cover her the last couple of years. And I was at the U.S. Open and also at Wimbledon last year. So I've had kind of a front row seat to that comeback. And it's been really interesting to see.
If you had a favorite sports venue, let's say you could visit one more sports venue in your life and one more event to cover, what would your two answers be?
All right. So I've never covered an Olympics or the French Open. So that's my bucket list in terms of being a reporter and wanting to cover something. And visiting something again, what's my favorite?
Yeah, if you had one place to go to watch a game.
Madison Square Garden is amazing. I think it's an amazing place to watch a game. I love the ceiling. I mean, just in
I know what you mean.
Yeah,
I know what you mean.
It's like, it's interesting and it's unlike any other venue and there's an intimacy to it. I just like that venue.
That was Jane McManus, director of the Marist College Center for Sports Communication in Poughkeepsie, New York. She was speaking with 51%'s Ian Pickus. We're back with Dr. Sharon Ufberg and her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews Julia Broglie, who was inspired to create Broglie Box after experiencing her own mental health challenges and losing her older brother to suicide when he was 24. Broglie Box is an all-inclusive quarterly subscription box that focuses on delivering items and resources for mental health and stress relief.
Broglie Box started years before I actually even imagined the company coming to fruition, but I have a history of struggling myself with anxiety and perfectionism, OCD, depression. So I had been working on putting healthy habits into place for a long time. And then when I lost my brother to suicide, you know, my life basically flipped upside down. And I found that everyone started coming out of the woodwork, friends and family, people I didn't know, telling me their own story, which led to the collection of, you know, a lot of research and resources that I started putting together. So I was like, you know, there has to be a way to get this out into the world because we should be thinking about our mental health on a daily basis. And there really was nothing like this that, you know, people could gift to someone else and have it deliver straight to their doorstep, those items specifically for mental health.
Could you describe a couple of what items would be in the box? Like what would be in there?
Sure. So the first box went out in December and it has, so the items will change every quarter, but the category of items will remain the same. So there's something usually having to do with aromatherapy. There's something that has to do with fitness or physical exercise. something to like tactile, so like massage rollers, those types of things, a candle, a gratitude journal, some other inspirational type of writing, as well as tea or some nutritional information. So, and then each box includes the Peace of Mind magazine that has articles from psychologists, psychiatrists, different mental health experts, as well as all the resources that are out there. So apps that people can download on their phone, different organizations that have resources available, how to find a doctor, some simple stretching or yoga poses to help relieve stress, those types of things. So that all comes in the box every quarter, so four times a year.
That's so great. So let me ask you this. Why a quarterly box? Like, why this mechanism to get all these resources to people? Can you tell me a little about why you chose that method?
Sure, of course. I wanted to do something different than just launch a website. I think there's something to be said about getting a care package in the mail. And for Broglie Box, people can order it for themselves or they can order it as a gift for a loved one. And then in addition, you know, I have a history of working in the cosmetics industry, and this subscription box method really appeals and is really effective for my target age group. So I kind of combined my history and knowledge of that industry with sort of like this new way of imagining mental health. And I wanted to make taking care of yourself fun. It shouldn't be necessarily a job and, you know, having to go onto a website and having to find a doctor and having to find all these different resources. It just seems exhausting, even to someone like me. So, which, and I know the importance. So I wanted to think about a different way to have it be delivered physically to you in the mail. And then each box comes with a variety of items. So not everything is going to work for the same person. So this way, it's a low-risk way of trying a bunch of different things that could help you. And then if you find a method that works for you, then you can go on and order more of that specific item, for example. But it's a way to try multiple things.
I know your first boxes went out in December of 2018, and then the next ones are due to go out in March. How's it going? What's the response so far from the public?
Yeah, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. I knew that this would appeal to some people, but I wasn't expecting the level of response that I got. So it's been really, really an exciting time.
What are you hoping happens in this coming year? You mentioned your target audience. Who would that be? What's the age range? Who are you looking to reach this year?
Our target age range and demographic is really those in their late teens and in their 20s. So obviously college students, that's a big target for us. You know, there's 20 million college students in the United States. So if I could even reach not even 0.1 of a percentage of that, that would be amazing. So by the end of the year, we're really hoping to get our subscribers up to 10,000 and be across the U.S., maybe, you know, across like 15 or 20 universities to really have a presence. We want Broglie Box to be a household name. And then my big vision for the company, because at this point, everyone receives the same set of items, but I would like to eventually have sort of a semi-customized box where there's a couple different options for people. And then I would love the box to be more completely customized for that particular individual. So therapists or psychiatrists can actually go on and pick things specific for their clients.
Julia Broglie from Broglie Box, thanks so much for your wonderful idea to help people, and, you know, wish you so much luck, and thanks for being here today. I'm Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature on 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1544.